Welcome to the Interior Health Nursing Grand Rounds, a podcast conversation. I am your host, Allison Thomas, and on this podcast, we talk all things nursing and healthcare. I work as the clinical nurse specialist in the Trauma Services Network in Interior Health. Interior Health would like to recognize and acknowledge the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Dakal Dene, Tanaha, Inglekatma, Shawepam, Statliam, Sioux, and Chicoltean nations, where we live, learn, collaborate, and work together. And I'm so pleased to bring a group of friends with me today, and I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves, and you'll see what I see, which is we've got a panel of experts here with us today. Can I start with you, Kathy? Would you introduce yourself and give us a bit about your healthcare background?
For sure. I want to say I'm awfully happy to be here with you today as well. My name is Kathy Bush. I go by Catherine Bush if you're looking for me in email. My background is as a medical lab technologist and an epidemiologist in medical microbiology, infectious diseases, that type of thing. I am the director for the IPAC program. I've just come over from Alberta AHS about a year ago, and I'm really pleased to have such a strong team here and a great partnership with Dr. Bibby. And I'll throw that over to Helen as her next introduction.
Great. So I'm very excited to be a guest here today. I'm Dr. Helen Bibby. I completed my medical school up in Prince George at the Northern Medical Program and did my residency in medical microbiology in Calgary, so also coming from Alberta. And I've been with Interior Health for 2 years. I'm currently the IPAC Medical Director. And as a throwback, I was originally born and raised in Princeton, BC. So feeling very fortunate to be back in the interior and working with this great team.
Okay, so you're a local, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. Yep.
Awesome. And Amanda.
Hello. Yeah. So my name is Amanda Keene. My background is being a registered nurse. So I worked in the healthcare field for going into my 12th year now. I did med surg, long-term care, worked in some short stay units. So kind of a jack of all trades, master of none with my nursing background. And then I moved into infection prevention control about 5 years ago now. The last year I've been the manager of the Central Okanagan, and I've recently taken over the East Kootenays portfolio as well for our program. I kind of grew up in the area as well. So I grew up in Armstrong, went to nursing school in Kamloops, and kind of been putzing around the Okanagan since then.
Amazing. Thanks all. My first question, I like to start with the basics. So can you tell me, you all work in the IPAC realm, which is infection prevention and control. So can you tell me what IPAC is and what IPAC is not? Maybe we can start there.
I'll have a stab. It's Kathy. As part of my career, I did a couple years in patient safety and looking at adverse events. So one of the ways I think about IPAC is patient safety, but with all the bug stuff. So patient safety and, you know, quote unquote, that's the med rec, the falls, all the kinds of other ways we can harm patients. But infection prevention control is specifically about microorganisms and trying to prevent transmission of those microorganisms. When our patients come in, we don't want to make them sicker. So that's what I think about for IPAC.
Sure. I'm happy to add to a bit of that well for our sort of frontline staff there is like a lot of the time we do get associated with hand hygiene and we do a lot more than that. So while hand hygiene is a foundational practice, IPAC supports areas such as, you know, construction and renovation, communicable disease exposures, emerging pathogen responses. We also help improve day-to-day practices around clean disinfection, PPE, as well as supporting patient cohorting and patient placement as well. So lots of different fields in our realm.
I just add that I feel that IPAC is a culture, just what Kathy's saying, with patients, staff, and safety really being paramount. These facilities are places where we have sick patients, some of which have infections. We have additional risk factors with antibiotic exposures, promoting antibiotic resistant organisms, et cetera. And so what's paramount to keep everyone safe is IPAC and this type of culture.
I love that. Thanks for sharing. Of course, we always want to keep our patients safe, of course, fundamental, but it's also so important to know how to keep ourselves safe. So thanks for sharing that as well. So can you tell me what I hear a lot when I hear things from the IPAC world is I hear this phrase, the point of care risk assessment. Can you tell me
what the process of that point of care risk assessment is, and maybe where you think people go wrong the most or they have the most challenges in that process.
Sure, happy to. So the point of care risk assessment is something that every healthcare provider does before every single task and every interaction with a patient or their environment. I think what's kind of missing from that and what people tend to forget is that they have the power to determine what PPE they wear, how they do their work safely, in addition to all the things that we help them do. So for example, if someone has a droplet in contact sign on their door, that healthcare professional has the power to decide to go above and beyond that PPE depending on the task they're going to complete. So if they're going into that room and they're technically maybe the patient's not on precautions and they're not required to wear a gown or wear a mask and eye protection, but they're looking at that patient and there is coughing, there may be vomiting, you know, you have the power to put that mask on and put that eye protection on and make your work safe for you. I feel like a lot of people, especially since the pandemic, rely on IPAC for direction, but we're really just trying to empower the staff member that you can choose to go above and beyond any PPE that is recommended to conduct your work as safely as possible.
Just to add a little bit to it, I love a good model. And so the IPAC point of care risk assessment is really based on this transmission model called the chain of infection. And the idea is when you do something as an intervention, whether that's cleaning or putting on PPE or putting a person on additional precautions, we call it breaking the chain. And it's about what is the organism? How does that organism typically move around? What is that patient's risk factors like? Are they, in Alberta, we call it leaky, drippy, gooey. So do they have secretions? Are they a clean, contained package and they're able to walk around? Are they cognitive? They can clean their hands. So a lot about patient ambulation, right? So there's all these different strategies, including vaccination and including cleaning the environment, that sort of thing. And that all weighs into an individual's point of care risk assessment. Myself, I think the biggest place that people go wrong is they don't even think about it. I think it just becomes out of sight, out of mind. You know, they're busy, they have their mind on something else, and suddenly they're in a patient room and the patient starts vomiting. So now they've got exposure to that, you know, aerosolization that's happening. They've got to think about cleaning up. They've got to think about PPE. They've got all of this stuff. Whereas if you know, this patient's been nauseous all day, maybe this is something I should anticipate, that it would help. I mean, it saves time in the long run thinking, oh, maybe I go in here with a mask because you just never know. And wow, didn't I hear about Noro in the shopping mall? So
that's a really good one, Kathy. And I don't know how many times I went to listen to a patient's chest and they started coughing in my face. So that's when I've started to wear a mask and eye protection when doing those assessments, because you just sometimes it's just a little bit too late once you get in there.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I was just nodding my head, which cannot be heard over the microphone.
No, that's great. That's really helpful. Now, I'm wondering in my mind, which I'm sure is not accurate because I know you're so busy, you're probably never sitting in your office. But in my mind, you're sitting in your office and you get about 4,000 phone calls a day from people asking questions. And I'm wondering, what is it that you do want people to call you about? What are appropriate consults to IPAC? What kind of things are you sitting here wishing that nurses knew that when this thing happens that I should call IPAC? What are some of those things?
I feel like we could probably break that down almost into two categories, because there are situations during the week that you're going to want to call your frontline infection preventionist. And one of those scenarios where you call our medical microbiologists, such as Helen, for the sort of those after hours emergent support. So I don't know if we want to start with emergent or, yeah, Helen, why don't you start with what do we want to call med micro for? What's an appropriate consult to our med micros?
Sure. I'd go back to what's in a name. So infection prevention ideally comes before infection control. So I do like getting phone calls earlier rather than later if there are any types of concerns. And on call, we cover all sorts of things, be it from presentations with infectious organisms after we've confirmed a pathogen in the lab, for instance, and other concerns, including outbreaks and alerts, issues with facilities like floods. So it's very dynamic, but I would say ideally as soon as there's a question, should IPAC be involved, happy to be on the other line sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And I think one thing from like the infection preventionist sort of regular day-to-day sort of things is, you know, we're here to help you understand. So we hope that if you have a question about a policy or procedure and you're not sure how to stand it, we're help there to walk you through it. We definitely really like to know early again about sort of clusters, or if you're seeing some patients with symptoms that have been on your unit for a while, such as, like, you know, maybe new vomiting, new diarrhea, a bunch of patients are developing cold symptoms, definitely give your infection preventionist a call and they can kind of walk you through and support you with, are we maybe going into an outbreak here? Is there something going on? Is this normal for this patient? If you have any questions about, hey, like, I have this patient, I'm not even sure why they're on precautions. And we're also really readily available for our access and flow teams for cohorting and patient placement. I know our healthcare system right now, like, not every situation is ideal and we can't always follow best practices, but we're here to support you, sometimes choose between two very difficult options based on what your needs are. So really like to be called for those scenarios as well.
I think the other time we really like getting calls is when people just see something and wonder about it, you know, like, I saw this, is this really best practice? Should we be thinking about things in a different way? We get a lot of those kinds of calls when people are looking at their own policies and procedures. So allied health, maybe around specifics around their equipment, or we've got a question right now about how garbage should be managed in an OR when the sterile core is also the transit corridor in the OR. Mm. So what's best practice for that? So I think part of it is our buildings are really quite old in most cases. So I was in the Kootenays last week and in a new part of the facility, and it was like, whoa, you walk in and gorgeous. But that's not the usual situation. So it's like, how do we manage things the most safely, the most efficiently, the most sustainably that we can? And that's, again, where I think an infection control professional can really come in and understanding the risks and the sort of the literature, what we usually think, and how do we adapt it to this situation? So I think our staff spend a lot of time helping people think through those problems.
Mm-hmm. It's so relieving to know that there's people that you can talk to and walk you through those situations, right? Where you think, oh, I have these two conflicting issues. How do I go about that? I think it's so, at least for me personally, I always feel relieved when I don't have to make that decision by myself, that I know that there's support there for me. So just really appreciate that. And then I think my other half of that question is, what are some kind of unnecessary phone calls that you get, or do you find that people sometimes confuse you with somebody else? Dr. Bibby, I'm thinking about you. Do you ever get infectious disease phone calls to your line? Is there anything that you'd like to clear up and say, we actually don't need to talk about these issues, or you might be looking for somebody else? Is there anything that you get, any patterns that you see?
Yeah, I'd have to say it's very dynamic on call. So medical microbiology, we do cover the entire region of IH, and we have multiple aspects of what we cover, including critical results, being there for clinicians to provide advice on workup, treatment, consultation questions, as well as infection control. So in general, I would say I err on the side of more communication is better than less. And if anyone is in doubt, I'm always happy to receive those phone calls. And even if the result of that phone call is no action is needed or there is no concern, I think that is an outcome in and of itself, right? And so that'd be my answer.
Yeah, and I kind of echo what Helen is saying, is we love being available and encourage our teams to reach out if they need support. Even if that phone call is just like, yeah, like, we actually do have this written somewhere. Were you aware of this resource that you can print out and have your unit or refer to maybe when we're not here? So a lot of like that, if you're unsure, just reach out and we can probably point you in the direction of a resource that is available all the time. I know we definitely work parallel with a few departments. So we work parallel with sort of workplace health and safety. So that's sometimes workplace health and safety questions kind of come to our team. For example, when can I return to work after an illness? That's something that IPAC wouldn't be responsible for. That would be, you would call your workplace health and safety representative to determine when it's safe for you to return to work. And we also kind of get some interesting consults because of the precautions that are required, but with hazardous drugs. So hazardous drugs isn't a communicable disease, but PPE is required. So there's lots of questions for us for those. And we always usually have to filter them back to either pharmacy or, again, workplace health and safety about how to appropriately handle those.
Yeah, that's really good to know. Now, I'm actually a little afraid to ask this question, but is there anything new or up and coming or emerging, dare I say, pathogens or emerging practices in your world? Is there anything, what's the gossip? What's happening in the IPAC world?
we have some pretty good stories.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long this podcast is. Exactly.
Do you want me to start, Helen, and then we can tag team it all three of us?
Let's do it.
I think one of the things that I really, really think about right now, and especially with the measles activities that we're seeing all across Canada, is the threat of re-emerging disease. So things like polio, measles, things that we thought, God forbid, smallpox, I can't believe that would be a terrorist thing. But honestly, like things that since pandemic are probably going to pop up at us again that we didn't even contemplate 20 years ago might ever come. You know, it was already in the historical archives. And I think, as everybody knows, through COVID-19, there was a lot of vaccines concerns, there is vaccine hesitancy, there's a lot of misinformation. You know, it was also people's regular schedules got interrupted for vaccination, that sort of thing. So I was at a really good talk once, and one of the other, the travel physician was saying, you know, Air Canadensis, like it's the major travel vector. So a lot of things coming at us from all different countries too. So I think about the Hajj starting up and, you know, the potential for outbreaks there with those kinds of communicable diseases where people, a large group of people are together, and if it's a very infectious organism, you get that kind of problem. So I think, you know, the past is going to come and bite us, never mind what's upcoming in the future. So Helen, do you want to go on the next bit?
Yeah, so I just echoing that, it's a very dynamic time right now with infections, and we are seeing rates that were prior to that of when vaccines were introduced. We're seeing soaring rates, including other diseases such as syphilis and other sexually transmitted infections. Just as a shout out to this multi-jurisdictional outbreak that we currently have in Canada with measles, which is in context of a global upsurge in measles, we're really wanting to make sure that messaging is out for staff to know their vaccine status, be fit tested, how to recognize measles in the community and acute care, patient management, get that mask on that patient, get them into an airborne isolation room, and how to get the right test. So a lot of work has been done on that front. I'll also just give a shout out for avian influenza. So this has been detected globally. And earlier this year, we did have a teenager admitted in BC that was critically ill with avian flu. Most of these cases around the world in terms of human infections are with contact with infected poultry or other animals, for instance, cattle, but something that we're also keeping a close eye on. And another couple ones, pertussis, Mycoplasma pneumoniae, both of those have had elevated cases as well.
I think the other piece, you know, in a forward-facing way is the effects of climate change and what that has on sort of the microbial world. So it's not only about vectors changing, so kinds of mosquitoes that would cause different kinds of diseases, their territory is expanding as the world is heating up. So things that we didn't see that might have been in Central America are becoming pretty commonplace in the States, and it won't be too long before, you know, if things continue to warm up, again, their territory expands, we start seeing things that we never used to. Another real sort of horror is some of the effects of climate change on microbial evolution. So a bug that we really worry about right now, it's kind of The Last of Us, you know, this idea of a fungus that is going to zombify you. That it's not as bad as that, but you can see where people are going with it. But this particular yeast evolved to tolerate human temperatures because of the climate change in its area. So one of the things that protects us against yeast is that they are typically cooler. Like they like to grow in 30 degrees or more like 37 as a body temp. So you don't get that. But it adapted to that heat. And so now it can cause infections. Candida auris has been seen in some very serious infections. And again, with antimicrobial resistance, we really run out of the antibiotics that we can use to treat these kinds of infections. So climate change is going to bring all kinds of stuff at us that we weren't anticipating, because the bugs always win. They evolve to whatever their situation is, and they get ahead of the game. But that is a good segue to routine practices and point of care risk assessment. Ha ha.
Tell me more, Kathy, because now I'm really freaked out. So what can I be doing?
It's all the things that we've talked about, right? It's about, look at your patient. Are they, you know, showing any kind of symptoms or something that you should be thinking about with PPE? An unusual presentation, like hop on the phone to the microbiologist and the physician. hand hygiene. And the reason we harp on about hand hygiene is because really cleaning your hands of these potentially pathogenic organisms that you can take home yourself, your family, your community, as well as transmitting to our patients or residents. So hand hygiene is kind of a proven winner. I'm a gardener, so that's like the point thing. And then cleaning, disinfecting, making sure that, you know, all of those things, we're reducing the bioburden and the potential of that bug getting around.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying all the things that we already know we're supposed to be doing are the keys to us protecting
everything our communities. Yes.
Okay. You know, I find it's interesting, kind of the longer you're around, the more you realize that the only thing that ever matters is the basics. So on the one hand, that's kind of disappointing because we all hope that there's some magic something that's going to emerge to help us with our problems. But on the other hand, it is a little bit comforting to know that we actually do know the basics and we actually are equipped with the tools that we need to protect ourselves and our patients and our communities. So that's a really helpful reminder. Could you point out to us some of your favorite resources? Are there certain websites or books or conferences that you would point people to if they had an interest? Is it still Do Bugs Need Drugs? Is that aging me? Or is that nope. Still the go-to?
That's still a thing. Amanda, do you want to start off with this one?
Oh, gosh. So kind of like going back to the basics, we do have, like, this is an internal resource that everyone would have access to without paying additional fees or anything like that, is we have our infection prevention and control page on SharePoint. And we have a routine practices section, and that includes everything you should be doing with every patient, including, you know, like how to clean and disinfect, when to do hand hygiene, your point of care risk assessment. So really identifying those basics and what you'd be doing in your everyday practice, because then even if something came through that you didn't know about when it came through the door, the chances of you being protected are pretty good. So just keep doing those basics and becoming an expert. And like we kind of said before, doing that muscle memory and building it into your practice is what's really going to protect you from even all these unpredictable things in the long run.
In terms of other websites, PICNET, so the Provincial Infection Control Network for BC with HSA, has a really excellent website, lots of resources, surveillance results, that kind of thing. BC CDC has some great dashboards. You can look at the prevalence of different organisms in respiratory season, you know, how much COVID are we seeing, how much rhinovirus, that kind of thing. Wastewater data, that sort of thing too. Alberta Health Services has a really good website too, and I'm very prejudiced because my team built that. So, Library Services is another really good place. Like, you have access to a lot of journals. So if there's a specific sort of topic you're interested in infection control, and we recently, we've got the CSA guidelines there, the Canadian Standards Association. So things around disinfection. Sort of like where are the guidance on that? Those are sort of the original documents. And sorry, Helen, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say that Do Bugs Need Drugs? So Dr. Edith Blondell-Hill is a medical microbiologist and infectious disease specialist here. So that is a great resource full of a lot of information. Something that I use on a daily basis is ProMed. It is just a surveillance system for around the world reports of things that are popping up all over the place. And it just helps you keep track on what's occurring around the world, including the World Health Organization also has disease outbreak news. So there's a few international resources that I use just to get a sense of what's happening. Mm-hmm.
That's great. That's helpful to know. And Kathy, you're so right. The Interior Health Librarians, can we just shout out to them for a minute? They must hate to see me coming. I email them all the time and they are so wonderful and always get me the information that I need. So that's a great resource that I think a lot of people don't know is available to us, that they can pull articles for us, they can do literature searches for us, and they can just generally support you with finding reputable information. So,
and crazy fast, like a couple
they're
times,
so fast.
Holy moly. Like, I've done a couple of requests around just sort of, you know, questions that we've had, and you know, gosh, within a day, 2 days, like, here's this list of articles. They're fantastic.
Yeah, they're our heroes. I hope more people know about them. Or maybe I don't, because then maybe they'll be too busy to do my requests. So maybe we should edit that out. okay, well, I think my last question for all of you is, if you could tell every nurse in interior health one thing about IPAC, what is that one thing that you want everybody to know?
Sure, happy to go first, guys. So I think one thing that comes up sort of over and over again is IPAC isn't black and white. Mm. We really live in the world of the gray, because not every patient, not every site, not every hospital, not every situation is exactly the same. So sometimes we get sort of a sense of frustration that recommendations might change or might be a little different than last time it happened. So we're taking, that's why we have experts here from the infection prevention control team, is to make those recommendations for all of those gray scenarios. But if you're having trouble like understanding why something is different this time than it was before, or why IPAC made a recommendation, we encourage you to ask those questions, and we can help you with the learning of why those decisions were made. But yeah, we can't always just give a black and white answer. And I know that can be quite frustrating for some people, but there's lots of factors into decision making.
My message would be that IPAC works. I know that we may have scared you throughout this interview with these horrible, you know, pathogens, but they are invisible. And so they can be overlooked. But as we really emphasize, they do have big impacts in terms of increasing resistance or newer re-emerging pathogens that have ramifications for our hospitals, our staff, and our patients. However, IPAC, we've got you.
I think we used to always say we wish bugs were big as lice, because nothing gets a fine than lice, right? Like bed bugs. It's probably a tie. I mean, I think for me, IPAC isn't some separate thing. It's not something, it's part of your practice. So in everything that you're doing, you know, you're doing hand hygiene, you're wearing gloves as appropriate, you're wearing PPE as appropriate. It's just, it's part of what you're doing. It's just what we do. And I think to try to separate, you know, hand hygiene away from your clinical tasks, that's where it starts becoming problematic, or I'm too busy, or that kind of thing. So I think really just think about how IPAC recommendations and you know, our strategies for prevention embed within your practice. And I think that'll sort of help too.
Great. Awesome. So I just want to thank the three of you. You're so busy. Thanks for taking the time out to chat with us today. And I hope that we can talk to you again another time. And I'd just like to say thank you to Interior Health Professional Practice Office for supporting this project. And as always, a very special thank you to the marvelous Dwayne Walwin, who is our sound editor and makes these podcasts happen behind the scenes. So thanks, Dwayne. And Amanda, Kathy, Dr. Bibby will be talking to you soon, I hope. That's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. We know you're busy and your time is valuable. Thank you for spending some of it with us. Thank you for your commitment to your profession and to your patients, and being a part of the journey of building a culture of excellence around nursing in our health region.